Hello and welcome. It's Tuesday and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tomorrow, Nikki Folsom will join us. We're going to talk about the haunted Harlequin Theater, ghostly experiences behind the scene. And then on Thursday, Timothy Renner will be joining us. We'll be talking about a history of wild men, gorillas, and other hairy monsters in the Keystone State. That's Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. Then Friday, we wrap up speaking with Nate and Kaylee Ratterman. And they have and are the owners of the Museum of Shadows in Elmwood, Nebraska. We're going to talk about their creepy old 127-year-old building and all of the haunted artifacts and objects that they put in store into this museum. Some of the chilling stories and more, plus a brand new theater of the mind. And remember, today is Tuesday, so it's True Crime Tuesday time. Deadly Voices with Chris Swinney is our topic. Imagine this. Not one, but two serial killers working the same area at the same time, but not working together. As a matter of fact, hating each other for being in each other's areas. Serial killer Herbert Mullen terrorized the Santa Cruz, California area at the same time the infamous co-ed killer Edmund Kemper also killed in that area. You have got to hear this story to believe it. That's on True Crime Tuesday. And if you stay tuned after the show, you'll hear a small clip from that so that you can find out what you've been missing if you haven't subscribed yet. And how do you subscribe? It's real easy. Go to darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and when you click on it, it'll take you through. You will be able to subscribe right there. It's only $5 a month, just a buck and a quarter per episode. And if you don't like it, you can always cancel after a month or two, but give it a try. I'm sure once you pick it up, you're going to absolutely love it. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday on our show for years, and now we've got it available for you. And the only way we have to make it available to you, you get 5 days of paranormal talk radio here on Beyond the Darkness, and it's all available free to you through Podcast One. And for just $5 a month, you get four brand new 90 to 120 minute episodes delivered to you every Tuesday on True Crime Tuesday. So go sign up for that, make it a part of your world, and do it right now. And remember, stay tuned after today's show to hear a clip from today's True Crime Tuesday episode. Tonight, our guest joins us. It's been many years, way too many years, since she's been on the show with us. She's back tonight. Linda Zimmerman is our guest, and her book is called More Hudson Valley UFOs. And we're going to talk about strange cases of triangles, saucers, abductions, and sightings that have been ranging from 1908 all the way to today. And Linda Zimmerman is an author and researcher. She presents more UFO cases from the Hudson Valley of New York, including Western Connecticut and Northern New Jersey, using eyewitness accounts and personal interviews. And it's great to have you back, Linda. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me back. You're right. It's been way too long.
Yes, much too long, but we'll have to keep in better touch. And just let's give our listeners a little background on you. You have really done remarkable work and research on many different aspects of the strange and paranormal that we cover on the show. What was kind of your introduction? Why did you find such a fascination with this field?
Well, I was actually giving a lot of ghost lectures, as you know. Been doing that for several decades, and people would come up to me at the end of a ghost lecture and start telling me their UFO story. And I was like, why are you telling me this? And they said, well, it's all connected, isn't it? And I don't know what that connection is, but I guess areas of high strangeness have all kinds of bizarre things going on.
And that is a weird connection, right? For people to take a leap, going to hear a ghost hunter or ghost researcher, investigator, and then want to share UFO stories. I mean, you sounded, from what you just explained to me, a little confounded by the idea. But once you started looking into this, could you see why people would connect the two?
It took a while, but I started to see when I started doing the UFO research, I'd be at someone's house or having them on the phone talking about their UFO story, and I'd say, well, anything else strange happen? Well, you know, I have this ghost story. And I'm like, son of a gun, here it is again. So I don't pretend to know what the connection is, but a lot of locations and a lot of people who have had one type of sighting also have the other.
Have you personally witnessed a ghost?
I will have to say yes on two clear occasions. One was in Gettysburg, many years before I even started writing about ghosts. I never thought I was going to. And we saw a Confederate soldier walking through the wheat field. It was the anniversary day of the battle. And I thought he just looked too shiny and clean. And I said to my husband, well, he's the worst Confederate reenactor I've ever seen. he should be dirty and grimy. And he just, everything seemed to almost be glowing. And I bent down to get a pad and paper because I thought maybe I'd interview him because I was writing about the Civil War. And I sat up and he was gone. And I said, oh, no, he fell down. And we were waiting for him to get up, and he never did, and we went running out in the field to help him, but I think we were about 130 years too late, and he just simply vanished. And
you were looking through a portal of time at a moment in his life? Do you think that for him he was on the active battlefields of Gettysburg, or was he traversing our ground confused and wondering what it was that he was seeing?
Well, he didn't seem to be in any state of alarm, like he was being shot at. So I think I'd have to go with the latter one there, that he was just, it might have been the actual moment of his death. As I said, it was the day of the battle, and it was actually the hour that, you know, during the time the battle was being fought. And he just seemed to be wanting to walk back towards the Confederate lines and get home, which I have a feeling never happened.
How does that impact you when you see something like this? This is no longer just conjecture or secondhand stories, but you see this unfurl before your eyes, and you know the impact of what you're seeing and realizing that this is a soldier who gave his life for what he believed was right at that time.
Jaw-dropping stunned. If I had to put it succinctly, it's a life-altering experience because, as you say, it's not something other people are seeing or talking about anymore. You just had an experience, and how are you going to process this, and how do you handle this going forward? And it's certainly opened my eyes to more than just the possibility. It was the certainty to me at that point. And it was soon after that that I started researching and writing about ghosts.
Would you mind sharing your second encounter that you knew this wasn't a mistake, this wasn't a trick of the eyes, that you saw what you believed to be a spirit?
I was at a home that people were renting, and they had all kinds of nasty things going on. They had two dogs that died very mysteriously. Objects would fly through the room. Things would smash, get broken. Very, very violent, you know, poltergeist almost type activity. And they couldn't stand it anymore. They were leaving. And they called me and said, you know, you have 2 weeks before we move out if you want to come and investigate. So I think I was there the next night, and just very unsettling activity. You know, you're upstairs and you hear things slamming down in the basement. You go in the basement and things are slamming upstairs and, you know, just kind of messing with you type of activity. And as I was packing up my gear, I saw this. I was in a dark room, and just enough light was coming through the curtains from the outside that I saw something dark blocking the light moving from left to right. So I grabbed my infrared camera and snapped a few photos. And I thought I had seen something, but when I got home and put the pictures on the computer, I mean, I just gasped. There was this dark, hunched over, almost hunched back figure, which is what the people were seeing. In fact, they would wake up in the middle of the night and this figure would be bent over looking at them in bed. Which is no wonder why they were moving out.
That would be enough to chase me right out of the door.
Absolutely. Night one. So when I, you know, as I said, when I saw that photo, which all these years later still gives me chills when I see it, because I realize I was in the room with that thing. And it turns out we believe the man who died in the house, who is now haunting it, have heard from several sources that he may have been performing illegal operations in his basement, shall we say, and lost a few patients and liked to experiment on women.
All right, so the type of experimental would be mostly on women?
Yes.
Okay, all right. I get where you're going with that. All right, and then if things went wrong, he would experiment on them?
Yes, and apparently a few lost their lives. So, yeah, I always say death does not improve one's personality, and he is still out to terrify women, even after death.
What is the, again, when you go in and you see this and you have this experience, what do you do then? I mean, what is the object that, all right, we now have seen this, we've all had this experience, we've got photographic evidence of this. What is the next step? Do you try to clear something like that?
Well, they moved out. I lost my access to the house, but I spoke to the caretaker to the property and made him well aware of what was going on. And unfortunately, a family looked like they were going to move in that had a young girl, and he said he was going to warn them. So whether he did or not, you know, which would, of course, risk his job if you tried to warn people away from renting the property, But maybe just being aware of it might help the people who were going to move in.
Right.
So normally I would have tried to get someone in there to do a clearing, which I have a feeling would have taken quite a while.
Right, because this, whatever it was dark and deeply entrenched in this home.
That is the word for it, deeply entrenched, for sure. And that was one of my most alarming and just absolutely frightening, and you just never felt comfortable for 1 minute on that property.
So here you've had these ghost-like encounters, and you've been doing this research and have gone out and investigated multiple locations and have been collecting people's stories for a long time. Are you finding a lot of crossover in these areas, Linda, where there are ghost activity, UFO activity, and even cryptid activity all taking place kind of in tandem?
Yes, that would be a town called Pine Bush, New York. They call themselves the UFO capital of the world, but okay. The East Coast, but they could easily call themselves the haunted capital of the East Coast. I've investigated numerous locations. It seems like every single home or business on the main street has some sort of dark spirit, some of them really bad. And also they have seen numerous types of creatures and hear strange sounds, and you name the type of activity, and it has probably been happening in Pine Bush.
So you've walked right into your own Twin Peaks with this town, right?
Absolutely.
What do we know about this area that's so special, Linda? Is there a reason? Do we find it on ley lines? Is it built over crystalline caverns? Is it heavily laden with granite or quartz or something underground? Why do you think this is such a nexus point for strange activity?
Certainly the geology is a factor. There have been studies conducted on the magnetic fields, and there are extremely high anomalous magnetic fields in areas where at least the UFO activity is very high. It is near a mountain range, the Shawangunk Mountains, which is rich with quartz crystals and granite. There is a fault line in the area. I can't say for certain whether it is directly under Pine Bush or not, but one of the bizarre things is the amount of underground activity. People for decades have been saying it sounds like there's machinery underground, and they see lights and craft actually coming up out of the ground and going back into it. And that is not very common in the world of ufology, but it's for a time it seemed to be a daily occurrence in Pine Bush. So is there physically something under the ground, or is it some way that they pass into our world through something under the ground? I don't know. But
can't it be said scientifically, too? Okay, if we're seeing this and we're having these experiences in this area, we know that there's high level of electromagnetic frequency or force that's in that area. We know that there are some other geomagnetic principles at play. And we know that these are known to cause hallucinatory effect. We know that when they were working on the Philadelphia experiment, they were trying to use electromagnetic frequencies to cloak and hide craft. Could it be that that all that it's doing is it's a natural occurrence causing our perceptions to be manipulated so that maybe it's a regular plane crossing in the sky, but because of the high levels of electromagnetic force, it appears to be some kind of craft cloaking in and out of visual perspective.
I could go along with that. That is a very intelligent way to look at it if it wasn't for the photographic evidence. Unless you know, with the old time film, I would think that can't be affected by electromagnetic fields so much. Perhaps the modern digital cameras can, but there has been a lot of photographic evidence of streaks of light and showers of sparks coming from the middle of the sky. Yes, we always have to consider that our human brain is being preyed upon by natural forces, natural fields.
Right. Well, and these sparks, I mean, I've been in locations, Linda. I've been in Eastern State Penitentiary when we did the investigation with you a number of years ago.
Yes.
When we were out there, we would see these Tinkerbell bursts of sparks. And I've seen them in the Queen Mary. I've seen them at Waverly Hills. I've seen them at Eastern State Penitentiary. And it's like all of a sudden you just see this little burst of light. But again, a lot of these places seem to have high levels of electromagnetic frequency. If I shuffle across the floor in my socking feet and then touch my daughter, I'm going to give her a good zap. Couldn't this be much like ball lightning has been used as an example, as a natural occurrence of something that, not understanding what you're seeing, would give you the impression of a craft or something? Couldn't there be this displacement of energy? And, you know, once in a while, this, the static builds up and it just crackles and causes this spark, and that's what we're experiencing. And again, I'm not trying to poo-poo the paranormal. I'm certainly a believer, but I'm also wondering if, you know, I haven't even really started to explore that philosophy until you and I just started talking about this, but could it just be that that's discharge, natural discharge from these locations?
I think for the balls of light and the sparkles and the, you know, the shower of sparks and things, absolutely. But metallic-looking craft with windows has also been seen going back at least two generations. So again,
all right, you got me there. That's a hard one to displace with electromagnetic frequencies. I wonder if it works. Why some of these areas are so populated with weird phenomena, though, is because of that energy. Does it work like a homing beacon to the strange? Dog whistles, dogs can hear it, we can't. It draws them towards us. I wonder if these natural occurrences of whatever the ground is releasing, the energy in the air is releasing, is creating kind of a lighthouse effect and drawing this phenomena to a location.
I think it does, and I think in some ways these things can feed off that energy. Just this past weekend, I was in the town of Brewster, New York, on a road called Magnetic Hill Road, and there was an iron mine there about 100 years ago or so it was very pure magnetite, which, of course, has strong magnetic fields. Here we are again. Now, this road and the adjacent area You can Google it. You will find cryptids. You will find satanic cults. You will find UFOs, and you will find ghosts and spirit lights and balls of light. So here we are again. You know, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the magnetic fields that are influencing people, or is it drawing the energy, or are these things brought there because of this natural energy in this area?
With the areas that you cover, especially with more Hudson Valley UFOs and such, you look into these stories. Are you finding and kind of able to grid or map out where these locations seem to be? And is there anything that we're finding in these specifically, you know, hotbed areas that might explain it? Nuclear reactors, electrical, gosh, I can't think of the word for it. The big machines, the like combines that you know, create the energy. Are there locations like that where it might seem to be feeding these things might be coming there to feed off of this residual energy that's all around?
Absolutely. We have Indian Point Nuclear Reactor, which is right on the Hudson River, and there have been numerous sightings of huge triangular or boomerang-shaped craft 300 feet over the reactor, just hovering there. In 1984, the guards actually had shotguns drawn and were ready to fire upon this craft, and a military helicopter was called in, and allegedly they fired on it and nothing happened. It had no effect, but I don't have confirmation of that. The witness I interviewed was there for the second sighting, where he said as this massive metallic object just hung over the reactor and, you know, obviously didn't care it was being seen, and just, was it feeding off the reactor? Somehow, was it just checking it out to make sure we don't blow ourselves up? I don't know, but that has certainly been a hot spot for decades.
It is interesting, isn't it, how many of these locations do seem to be around power plants?
Yes. We have several power generating plants along the Hudson. The substations themselves, I hear a lot of reports, many reports of people seeing whatever type of craft actually following the high tension wires, or hovering over one of the big towers for a high tension wire. So they do seem to, be able to somehow draw energy from it. Otherwise, I don't know why they would waste their time hovering and, you know, over these locations.
Right. Yeah, it does seem strange. What kind of cryptids are also in these areas that you're hearing a lot of? Do we have these kind of amorphous figures that shift and change shapes, like a lot of the UFOs that I hear that are reported in this way, where they maybe boomerang 1 second, cylindrical the next, blobs, and then, you know, they're gone? Do you see that with cryptids as well, that they're kind of morphing and changing in different areas?
I haven't heard of the shape-shifting type cryptids. I've heard your classic Bigfoot, the Dogmen. In fact, just last summer, some people were camping, and they claim several, you know, Dogmen creatures came after them. Pine Bush had one very bizarre looking creature. The best I can describe it is it looked like a Bigfoot with one of those old time diving helmets on, because it just had almost like a window or mirror, in front of its face, a round one, and like some sort of helmet. Small, bizarre type of, Jersey Devil type creatures have been seen in the Hudson Valley. So we have quite a range of, you know, and then your Greys and Nordics and reptilians and, you know, the Heinz 57 variety of alien as well.
It is a melting pot for love from every universe and planet, huh?
Absolutely. Everybody wants to come to the Hudson Valley.
Why though, this location being so crazy? Do you find that there's any kind of, and I don't mean to keep looking for correlations, but it boggles the mind. If you see this, if we look on a direct opposite side of the globe from where Hudson Valley, New York is, do we find that there is activity taking place there as well? Or do we find them in segmented regions where it's like every 1,500 miles or every 200 miles in one direction or the other, we're finding that this seems to be plotting itself along?
Well, that is a good point about the other side of the globe. I haven't looked yet, so I will be going to Google Earth after the show and see what are we opposite from. When I first started this, I thought it was going to be concentrated to just the wave in the lower Hudson Valley from the 1980s, where 25,000-30,000 people viewed these boomerang and V-shaped craft, and it just started spreading, you know, like you drop a red dye in water and it just starts seeping out in all directions. And I've gone back to 1908 with sightings in this area. They've spread to the surrounding states and up to Canada. So while we call it the Hudson Valley, you know, wave or the Hudson Valley phenomena, it has spread out. You know, I kind of joke and I say aliens without borders. Because, you know, to us, we say, well, this is New York and that's Connecticut. Well, that means nothing to whoever is
right.
Piloting these ships.
Right.
And obviously they were here long before Indian Point nuclear reactor and the, you know, electric substations and things. So I think perhaps, we go back to the geology. There's a lot of water here. There just may be something natural that attracts them to this area. And they've been here for longer than we can probably imagine.
1908, you're able to track this back and start finding accounts. Please tell me, what was one of the very first accounts you were able to uncover, and how hard was it to find that?
Well, I did a lot of mind-numbing newspaper searches on microfilm. Kind of makes me seasick when you're advancing the microfilm. But I was looking for things, back then they didn't call them flying saucers or UFOs. They referred to them as mysterious airships. So once I found one, I knew what time period and area to look for. And it just started, again, branching out. What started in Bristol, Connecticut in 1908 spread to the Hudson Valley throughout the summer of 1909, then spread throughout New England. There's a great story of two undertakers in Boston early one morning, probably going to collect a body, seeing this this large, dark-shaped object with a searchlight on it. And he said it was like, as if it was looking for someone. And that was a key feature. And if you are not aware of the history of aviation, no planes were yet flying at night in 1908 or 1909. And we didn't have these massive, well-built Zeppelins. We had some pretty pathetic dirigibles that weren't capable of carrying heavy searchlights and the batteries that needed to go along with them. And they certainly couldn't all hover and then accelerate extremely high speeds and be seen from Boston to New York in the same night. And then the phenomena spread up to southern Canada. And they said, oh, it's these damn Yankees, you know, muscling in on our land. And they even joked about it was Vermont grasshoppers with lanterns. They didn't know what to make of it. But certainly nobody said they were Martians or aliens. they thought perhaps the Wright brothers or Thomas Edison had developed some amazing new craft that could fly at night and have these bright lights on it. And they waited and they waited for the news to come out. And of course it never did, because nobody had such a craft then. And in the last 110 years, no one has found a prototype, a blueprint, nothing to show that anyone had something that with those flight characteristics.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, to go back that far, we have mysterious airships. Have you scrolled through going further back for strange lights in the sky, things like that that might be trigger words?
Yes, I found in the 1870s and 1880s in this area, they would call them spook lights or ghost lights, or think it was a sign from God that, there was this brilliant light that followed them in their carriage. There was one, it's called High Mountain in New Jersey, which apparently is still considered to be very weird and strange today. In the 1880s, people were terrified to go there because there were lights darting around the treetops, and men would grab their guns and go up there to see what was happening and come running home terrified because these lights would be swirling around them. So I can't say, yes, those were UFOs. I can't say what it was exactly, but something was happening that far back that was worthy of being in a lot of newspaper articles.
Let's continue our journey into this very strange area and hear some of the other stories, from lights in the sky to triangle-shaped craft to abductions and more. Linda Zimmerman, our guest today on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Our guest tonight, Linda Zimmerman, and her newest book is More Hudson Valley UFOs. We are going to be talking about some of these hotbeds, these paranormal perfect storm locations, as we were just discussing, where so much has happened in certain areas. She went back in timelines to the 1908 for some of these mysterious airships that were flying in the sky and being recognized and sighted, and even further back in these weird night and ghost light anomalies that were being witnessed all over. Let's get back into this, Linda, and I'd love to hear some more of the strange stories you've got from all the research you've done. How many books do you have out now totally?
Over 30 total, about 15 ghost books and 3 UFO books at this point.
And I know you were big into ghosts. How is this affecting you now with, the UFOs? Do you find that this is a much more fascinating aspect? And if so, why?
Well, it seems to have definitely drawn me in, probably because of my own experiences and the passion and the intensity of the witnesses I've interviewed. Not that a ghost hunt isn't intense and fascinating, but these people coming from all walks of life, having these similar experiences and just wanting to finally tell somebody, maybe after 10, 20, 30 years. And to me, it's, the possibilities are just mind-boggling if even a fraction of these stories are correct.
Right.
What has been going on around here for all of these, centuries, and what are the implications, especially for people with missing time or who believe they've been abducted? I mean, that just steps up the game exponentially.
Yes, it does. Let's talk about that. It's one thing to see these anomalous lights in the sky, And let's face it, we can be wrong. We can make mistakes. I was pointing it out to my son the other day as we were driving here in Minneapolis. It was a little overcast, and there was this huge silver cigar-shaped craft flying in the sky. And I said, "Dude, what is that?" And my son looked up and he goes, "Dad, what is that? What is this? Oh my God, is that a UFO?" And I said, "Wait for it. Wait for it." And then it tipped and changed trajectory, and all of a sudden the wings were visible, and you could see it. But it shifted. But in that perfect twist, the way it was lined up, you could not see the fin or the wings on this craft. It was flying at a right level, and it was gray out. The sun was not casting on this, and it gave just this cylindrical cigar shape view until a slight tip of the wing, and boom, suddenly it becomes very obvious what you're looking at. So we know we're fallible as humans. We make mistakes, Linda. We look at things, we misinterpret, we misunderstand these things all the time. But that's seeing something in the sky. What about these cases where people are coming face to face with these beings? How do you differentiate between somebody just trying to inject themselves into a story as opposed to real encounters with these creatures?
Well, I think my many years of interviewing ghost witnesses kind of gave me the training to know who wanted to, you know, be the next Hollywood sensation and who had a genuine experience. So again, I'm certainly not infallible, but you definitely get a sense when people are exaggerating or perhaps even, you know, not completely healthy mentally. There are several of those. Many of those I've encountered. But the very first person I interviewed when I first decided, all right, I'm writing a UFO book. In fact, they were filming a documentary at the same time. I got a local production company interested. So we have the cameras set up. I said, oh, well, let's just do it in my home. No, big mistake. Let's set up the cameras. I'm going to interview this guy. And I thought, as you were saying, it's going to be lights in the sky. Well, it turns out to be a multi-generational abduction story. Wow. That I was just blown away, riveted. He started having abduction phenomena in the 1950s, followed him throughout his life, several incidents of missing time, the nosebleeds, even to the point of his wife being pregnant, and then she wasn't. That's the way he put it.
What?
She was, yes, on several occasions. No miscarriage. It was just that she wasn't pregnant anymore.
Now, had they been to the doctor to get a secure diagnosis that she, in fact, was pregnant?
Yes. She had been to the doctor. It was absolutely confirmed. There, no doubt. And then it was just gone. So this was my first interview, and I'm like, who have I just let into my house? But he was just so genuine, so sincere, and his elderly mother, who was in her 80s, was still alive. And I said, you know, I would like to speak to her. I would like to know what kind of child you were. Were you very imaginative? You know, I needed, for my sake, before I started writing about this, to get some sort of confirmation of who I was dealing with. So I'm talking to her, your quintessential sweet old grandmother type, and she's talking about, yes, my son was he said this happened and that happened. And she said, you know, it was the one with the big eyes like I used to see. And I'm like, time out here. What do you mean like you used to see? Well, the first time I saw them was 1937, she told me, and I almost fell out of my chair. Both she and the man she ended up marrying both were having abduction experiences, contact with gray aliens with large almond-shaped dark eyes back in the 1930s. And they also continued to have experiences the rest of their lives. And then their children and now their grandchildren are having the same experiences.
Are there any strange physical or medical anomalies that this family is dealing with?
Well, this man I interviewed has these very bizarre triangular-shaped indentations on the back of his neck. I can actually put my fingers in them. They're so deep. He had scoop marks on his leg. He had the nosebleeds. One morning he woke up and he said he used to, you know, kiss all his kids goodbye before he went to work. And he had to leave very early. So as he went into each room to kiss his child goodbye, their pillows were all covered in blood and they had all had nosebleeds in the night. And of course the missing babies.
What do we believe the nosebleeds have to do with this? I mean, perfect example. Last night I woke up 4 o'clock to a very weird sense in my room. I can't even begin to explain it, Linda. It's weird that we're having this conversation today, but I woke up very displaced feeling. And all of a sudden, I had this kind of weird numbing sensation in the left side of my, or in the right side of my head, and then my nose just started pouring blood.
Oh, boy.
And then that sensation lifted. At first, I thought, holy crap, am I having a stroke? But blood just started pouring out of my nose. I got up, washed up, cleaned up, and everything was fine. But that weird sense of foreboding and creepiness was just gone.
So, well, you know, yeah, that's pretty classic. For,
great.
I hate to break the news, but yeah, I hear this all the time from people who have this missing time abduction. One man, he was the head of the school system and a politician and, you know, someone who didn't really, would not benefit from spreading such stories. And he told me, that he'd wake up at night and this strange-looking humanoid with a large head and big eyes would be there. And the next thing he knew, it was morning and he had a bloody nose. And he went to several specialists and they finally put one of those scopes up into his sinuses.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, who's been scraping the inside of your sinuses? He had physical marks as if some sort of operation. And
all right, now listen, I understand, you know, taking some eggs, maybe some semen, trying to create little alien hybrids, but why are they digging up my nose, Linda? What are they mining for?
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm laughing, but the way you put it there,
right.
All I can think is there's some sort of valuable tissue samples they're taking or putting something in or taking something out. I don't know, but that is very creepy that you just had that happen last night. Had it ever happened before in your life?
I've had nosebleeds from time to time, sure, but this was weird because, like I said, I woke up with this just strange feeling of, I can't even really put my finger on the emotion or the feeling. It was just, I felt very discombobulated, which, you know, can happen when you wake up in the middle of the night. But it was just this kind of disoriented, something was off, something felt weird. And then there was this weird, and I'm probably going to get letters from every medical person out there and everybody that's quickly scanning WebMD, and I'm sure they're going to tell me about every horrific possible thing that I could have. But, you know, like I said, once it passed, I thought, wow, was I having some kind of, you know, aneurysm or stroke or what? But it was like more of a sensation of fear and anxiety all at once. At the same time, and then the nosebleed just came out of nowhere and just was like mad.
Yeah, that's
you never heard of a mad nosebleed before?
No, I've never heard of a mad nosebleed.
It was mad. It had a place to be and it did not want to be on my head anymore, so it was running for the hills.
Yeah, you know, you might want to have that checked out medically just to be certain. But I have heard this time and again where people disorient, they'll wake up outside or on the floor of their bedroom, or their clothes will, you know, their pajamas will be on inside out, and they're fearful, disoriented, the bloody nose, the headache, and it's like, what just happened to me? So I would at least have it, you know.
Oh, yeah, I'll definitely, especially if this happens again, I'll be going in and checking on this. But I was just curious why you believe there was something. What does the nose have to do with it?
I don't. It just seems they go in and scrape the inner sinuses there, or some sort of probe. I don't pretend to know what's behind these,
okay.
But you know, I have certainly seen the pattern.
Now, are there specific types that are associated with this type of activity, or do all of the different alien races seem to like to dig up our noses?
I don't know. The people who have talked to me have all described very short, almost child-sized, skinny, spindly legs and arms and neck, big head and big eyes, and either very white or grayish. And that is also a very common theme through this type of activity. But again, to have two people that were having this back in the 1930s, long before that iconic image on Whitley Strieber's book Communion, you know, hit the bookshelves, and you know, because some of the skeptics say, oh, it's mass hysteria because this is such a common image now in movies and books. Well, it wasn't in the 1930s and 40s. So I think we can discount the mass hysteria theory.
Right. Now, let's go back to the family. So they're telling you, oh, yeah, this has been happening to us since the 30s. And you start collecting the story. And right now you find yourself in the middle of a generational abduction scenario. And what is it like, I mean, to be in this environment? And then seriously, Linda, do you think, boy, by investigating this, am I letting the visitors realize that I'm poking around? Do you have any concern for yourself?
I certainly do, because right after he left the house, now I live on a street where I say I could take a nap in the middle of the road. We had so little traffic. A dark van with blacked out windows pulled to the end of my driveway and just sat there. And I'm looking at it. I assume they're looking at me. And my husband's like, oh, I'm going out and see who this is. I was like, don't you go out there. And so I stood in my living room and it was kind of crazy, but I said, I am no threat. All I'm doing is interviewing people. I'm not claiming government conspiracies or this or that. And the van pulled away. And I was like, okay. I started having phone.
Well, I was talking more. I wasn't even thinking about the governmental conspiracy angle. I was thinking more of turning yourself onto the aliens. Now that they know that you're aware that they're out there and they're doing this, were you afraid they might come visit you? But
well,
you're getting bothered by the shadow government or the men in black.
Or was it, you know, some people speculate the men in black are aliens. So I didn't know at that point, but I just knew there is, you know, the one time in the whole time I've lived here, a dark van with blacked in windows is sitting, you know, at the end of my driveway. I didn't know what to think. Some of my files were erased on my computer. In fact, I spent a whole day writing up the story of this man, and I'm a compulsive saver on my computer. And I came back upstairs. The file didn't exist on my computer anymore. Dropped phone calls, and I'm like, oh, God, what have I gotten myself in for? And certainly I was worried that I was going to draw who knows what to myself. So at that point, I realized no more interviews in my living room. I go to them
yet here we are. You're in your living room, I'm in mine, and we're having this discussion.
And you just had a nosebleed. So,
right. Well, the aliens are taking care of me. Men in Black have got you handled, so this whole thing is fine. What did this family think at the end of it all? I mean, what are they just accepting of their role that they are the bacteria in this alien petri dish? They're just going to keep feeling this and dealing with this, or are they looking for help in a way to break this cycle?
Well, the mother was certainly very concerned for her children. She repeated over and over, "I just didn't want them to scare my children." And she felt so helpless. They both did. Because you can't protect your kids from this, you know, you just can't. The son, you know, the man I interviewed, he kind of thinks this is all cool now. Now that it most of it is behind him, mm-hmm. He's fascinated by the subject, goes to all sorts of conferences, loves to talk to people, you know, about their experiences. But of course, I'm sure he was very concerned when it started happening to his kids. So it's a complex set of emotions for sure. The abductees, contactees I've dealt with range from beam me up now, I can't wait to be taken away, to one man recently told me I would shoot them all if I could. Everybody handles it differently.
Certainly. All right. So that's one of the groupings that you cover and talk about in the new book. Let's hear about a couple more of the cases that really, you found fascinating and just compelling in the way that it's been told and what they're sharing.
One of my favorite from all of my books involves a woman who was a professional plane spotter. I didn't know there were such things.
There's one. There's another. Okay, I'm done today.
All right, pay me. She worked at LaGuardia Airport, and her job was to identify the type of craft, as it's coming in for a landing. So she needed to know civilian, military, and commercial aircraft of all types, and then get the tail number and match it up to what the transponder was telling her. And I'm like, why did you do that? Because drug runners would hijack a plane, change the E in the tail number to an F, and think they could just land with their cargo of drugs in the middle of a major New York airport. And they caught a lot of people that way. So this was her job, identifying aircraft at a distance. She was on her way home one night, mm-hmm. and there was this massive craft filling the sky that was so huge, she couldn't even tell what shape it was. So she called the, we have a White Plains, Westchester County Airport. She called a friend of hers at the tower, who was the radar man, and she said, "Do you see anything on radar?" He says, "I see it. It's enormous. I've never seen anything like it." Well, soon after getting off the phone, several Air Force personnel with guns drawn kick open the door to the tower, knocking tables over, threaten this radar man and everybody on duty that night that what they saw was a flock of birds and that they would be very sorry if they said otherwise. And this was in the 1980s, that they were still pulling this kind of stuff. I want to use a different word. Intimidating people with guns drawn and threatening them for doing their job and seeing something amazing.
What happened to the spotter? I mean, do you lose a job when you call in to start reporting things like that?
You at the very least lose a job. In fact, most of the airport personnel that this woman later talked to was similarly threatened with their jobs or worse if they ever said anything other than a flock of birds. And I said to her, you know, this was just a year or two I interviewed her, mm-hmm. and I said, aren't you fearful? She said, at this point in my life, what are they going to do to me? I don't care. So she's gone on the record. The book is out now. She said, use my name. I don't care. So will there be any future repercussions? I certainly hope not, but who knows?
All right. Yeah, boy, that gets crazy. But when you hear of a claim like that, I mean, it's so big, it's filling the sky. You can't tell what size it is. That's when a lot of people's BS meters start going off, Linda, because if something this grand in scale is being seen and they're pinging it on radar, why are the streets not running with people just absolutely terrified because the Independence Day craft is hovering overhead?
Well, that's what the environment was like in the 1980s during this wave. Mm-hmm. Most of the craft was 1 to 2 football fields in length. But some of them, I've heard this again and again, that it was so big, I couldn't tell what it was. One woman from Connecticut recently told me, she said the entire sky was filled with metal and lights. That's all she could see, metal and lights. This thing was so huge and so low. And the official explanation for these sightings by tens of thousands of people was it was 5 Cessna planes from a local airport flying in formation, and that's what people were seeing, and that's where their inquiries started and ended.
Unbelievable.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we dealt with. Now, this is, and here you've got two people in the know who would know what they're looking at and what's being pinged. What other stories do you have? Do you have other people with high credentials coming forward, kind of whistleblowing on this subject to you?
Well, they've certainly been forthcoming. You know, whistleblowing, I don't know, because the government not listening to our whistles. But there was an emergency room doctor who was on his way to the hospital one night, and he saw what he described as a large horseshoe crab-shaped object, and very educated man, you know, beyond his medical training. And he said he's looking at it, and all of a sudden it was gone, and it was a mile away. And then it disappeared from that location and was back close to where he was. It was like jumping from location to location, you know, very Star Trek-like. And again, here's a man who has nothing to gain from talking about seeing horseshoe crab-shaped craft, you know, jumping miles in the blink of an eye. Many police officers and military men have seen, you know, they're out at all hours, all over the place, seeing craft. There's a great story of the Danbury, Connecticut police force, who anybody who called with a UFO story was, you know, ridiculed. You know, what are you, drunk? You seeing pink elephants too? Until the chief of police and half his staff had sightings one night. And suddenly he became a firm believer and said, I know what I saw and I don't care what anybody tells me. You know, you've got to love when the ridiculing skeptic has their life-altering sighting.
Right.
A Marine Corps sniper, long history of service, saw a remarkable craft that, again, defied all explanation. And he said, you know, I'm trained to observe, you know, his life depends on what he sees and how he interprets it. So that, you know, doctors, lawyers, you know, I'd say politicians, but how can we trust them? one of the best stories I ever heard was from 3 teachers who stopped their car on the Taconic Parkway one night because a football field-sized triangle all lit up was hovering at treetop level over the road, and they stood under it for 20 solid minutes. And the next day, the official excuse was it was a formation of ultralight planes that mm-hmm. these people saw.
That hovered in one spot for 20 minutes.
Yes, yes.
And what about the people that experienced that? Did they have any lost time? Did they develop cancer? Did they any kind of ill effect from being directly underneath this craft for such an extended period?
Yeah, that's a good point. So far, they have aged nicely and are all healthy. But certainly people have developed physical ailments as a result. Cancer, thyroid disease, things that certainly would be in line with radiation exposure.
So there is something going on above the norm. And in your opinion, Linda, do you believe that these craft really are extraterrestrial, or do you believe that they are our craft and it's testing we're doing on our own people?
If we only were dealing with that wave in the 1980s, I'd probably say a good portion of that could have been military testing. But when I go back to the early 1900s, the 20s, 30s, 40s, I can't say that. I have to think that there was nothing on Earth that had these flight characteristics back then. So then I would have to then take the next step to say, yes, they were extraterrestrial.
These abductions that are taking place, are they always the same type, or are different versions of aliens doing the abductions? And did they ever get aboard the ship and then find out, yeah, it's the Greys that came for us, but once we got on board, it was a smorgasbord of Federation-type aliens in multiple different races?
For the people I have personally interviewed, it has been the gray aliens, the short ones, or sometimes taller versions of them. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have to take that back. There was one woman who claimed she was a little girl when this happened, and she used to call it the alligator person who came for her. And she interprets that now as it being something reptilian.
Fascinating stuff. Why that area? Why so much out there? And are you looking and cross-referencing with other hotspots? Are you finding very similar experiences, or are you finding that in that area it is something kind of unto itself?
Bits and pieces of what's gone on here are mm-hmm. certainly duplicated across the country and across the world, like, you know, the Belgian wave of triangles, very similar to what happened here. But taken as a whole, you know, well over 100 years, the incredible amount of abduction experience, the variety of craft, I think this area is unique. And I keep stating my opinion is that this is the number one hotspot in this country.
If that's true, why aren't we getting better evidence from it? If there's that much activity taking place, why aren't we getting, you know, I would think MUFON would be staking it out on a regular basis, looking to collect the video and photographic evidence of this stuff.
Well, that is the $64 question here. When I first went to the UFO Congress out in Arizona about 4 years ago, I thought, you know, I'm going to tell my Hudson Valley stories to these people. Now, these are hardcore ufologists. Not only did the vast majority, I'd say 90%+, never hear of the Hudson Valley wave, they had no clue where the Hudson Valley was. And I was astonished. And once I talked to them for 5 minutes, they're like, why didn't I know about this? Aren't more people aware of this? I don't know. All I can think is that the government disinformation program with these planes in formation from the 1980s just kind of put a stopper on it. And those who were familiar with the activity just immediately dismissed it as, you know, hoaxing pilots. That's the only thing I can think of because, you know, you have something like the Phoenix Lights, which was basically one night. And there's movies being made, and it's, you know, anniversaries of this, the event. That's a typical night for us in the Hudson Valley, you know? So I don't get it.
All right. Well, keep us in mind, Linda, and as you get more stories, we'd love to hear back from you and hear some of the other experiences. And I know you cover a lot of it in your new book. Where can they find the new book?
It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and just about every ebook format known to mankind.
Fantastic. So check it out. We'll have links up as well so you can follow Linda and her website and on Facebook so that it's easier to locate her. As we go out, do you have one last good creepy ghost story to share with us, Linda, from your years of research and collecting?
Creepy ghost story, one I haven't published yet. A little boy moved into a house. And he started talking about regular grandma. They're like, what are you talking about? He kept seeing an older woman sitting on this particular place in the stairs. She wasn't frightening. He used to talk to her all the time. Well, long story short, they spoke to previous owners. And this family's mother, this elderly woman, used to love to sit on that particular stair. And they come to find out that after she died, she was cremated and she had requested her ashes be scattered in this particular place she liked. Well, the son forgot to do it and she was sitting in an urn in his closet for all these past years.
Oh.
And once they followed her wishes and scattered the ashes, regular grandma was not seen anymore.
Very cool. Linda, thank you for being you and for coming back to visit with us, and we look forward to talking to you more in the future.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, and best of luck to you.
It's great chatting with you. Nikki Folsom, our guest tomorrow, the Haunted Harlequin Theater, ghostly experiences behind the scenes. And remember, today is True Crime Tuesday, where we're talking with Chris Swinney, Deadly Voices. We're talking about serial killer Herbert Mullen and the co-ed killer, Edmund Kemper, both terrorizing the same area in the same time. Stay tuned for a clip, an exclusive audio edition right from that episode, right now. So let's talk about this. Okay, so first of all, how rare is it that you have two serial killers in the same geographic location doing horrific crimes simultaneously, and they both decide to turn themselves in at the same time?
Yeah, and I don't know.
I mean, that's,
you know,
crazy right there.
Oh, that, yeah.
It sounds like a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And that's why, you know, law enforcement went from, man, what in the world's happening? Do we have two killers? To, holy crud, we got two guys in custody. Now what do we do? And so.
Right, but both of them at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It's the,
now,
you know, the only.
You see, this seems, and I'm not a cop. I've relatives in law enforcement, and I'm, you know, of course, a fan of all the detective shows, but it seems that it was a bad idea to put two serial killers side by side when you're not sure who's responsible for what deaths at this point.
Well,
especially when both of them are paranoid schizophrenics and could influence each other.
They did have some, so they didn't come together precisely like, you know, on a Tuesday they both showed up. There was a little bit of a gap there, but they both, at the time when they were sitting next to each other, there was a couple issues. One's logistics. It's 1973. There's not separate holding cells across the city where we can stash these two serial killers. It's logistics, right? You know, so, and they both have to go to court, and they're both going through separate court proceedings, and so they have to, their paths will cross. There's just, you know, today it would be easier for me to do that. To separate them, but at that point they didn't have that.
But they're in separate cells.
Oh yeah, they're not chumming up.
How is Kemper intimidating Mullen during this then?
Well, Mullen is a slight little guy. He was like 5'7", I think, 5'8", maybe 165 pounds. Well, Edmund Kemper was like 6'9".
Wow.
So he was a beast. And so he physically scared people. He scared the police. He scared the detectives. And he surely scared
Mullen, huh?
Mullen, you know, but he knew that. And
was,
you know,
Kemper pissed that Mullen was stealing some of his thunder because of his crimes?
You know, he didn't come right out and say that, but he did kind of make it known that, hey, I did what I did, and, you know, he did what he did. We're not together. We didn't work together, and, you know, I ate bodies and stuff. You know, that's what that Edmund Kemper was like. Hey, you know, he may have killed a few people, but, you know, I ate body parts.
But I'm the big bad guy.
Right.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And I'm big. They called him Big Ed, you know, obviously, because of his size and stuff. So, but they constantly were at each other's throats, but mostly it was just Kemper messing with Herbert. And Herbert just would plead with the guards, just, is there any way you could just get me away from this guy? And Ed would kind of relish in the moment, and he would say, you know, you guys think I'm crazy. And mind you, he's doing necrophilia and, you know, killing family members and eating body parts and stuff. But he tells the detectives and the people there that, hey, you know, you think I'm crazy, but, you know, this guy Herbert, he's completely lost his mind.
Well, what does that say about you when a complete psycho's like, hey, that guy's freaky?
Subscribe now for True Crime Tuesday by visiting darknessradio.com and clicking the True Crime Tuesday banner. Never miss another episode of True Crime Tuesday and Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Go there now, darknessradio.com, and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner. Do it now!